John had persuaded his parents that it would be good for Martha to spend a summer in Santa Monica, suggesting that he could get more work done if Martha kept house for him. Martha, who had never been away from home except at college, was eager to go. Once the plans were made, John also made no secret of his hope that his sister and John Milner would take an interest in each other. It was Nash who had proposed that they all travel together. Milner and Nash, of course, had known each other since Milner was a freshman at Princeton 4 years earlier. Though he had not yet completed his dissertation, Milner had already been asked by Princeton to join its faculty. Nash confessed to Martha that he was jealous of Milner's abilities, but he was clearly also charmed by Milner's self-effacing personality, his brilliantly lucid mind, and the younger man's lanky good looks. Ruth said her goodbyes as soon as the quartet arrived in Santa Monica. Martha, Nash, and Milner rented a small furnished apartment at the top of a rambling Spanish-style villa on Georgina Avenue, a stately street in the old section of Santa Monica, and 10 minutes' walk via Palisades Park from Rand. Nobody did much cooking or housekeeping. A guest who had been invited for lunch said, "The place hadn't been cleaned, ever. There were dust balls and dirty dishes. After looking around, they obviously hadn't prepared a meal. I decided to ask for eggs." John pushed the remnants of a previously fried egg aside in the frying pan. "Very nice people," I thought to myself. Martha got a job in a bakery. She hardly saw her two roommates, who seemed to spend most of their waking hours inside the Rand headquarters. Martha tried to visit their offices one day, but was barred by the guards because she had no security clearance. She and Milner went out to dinner once in the first week or two, but despite their many hours together in the car, Milner was uneasy and painfully tongue-tied, and it became clear to Martha that no romance was in the offing. The two men worked mostly on their own. Milner wrote a lovely paper called Games Against Nature. Nash dabbled with games that could be played using a computer. He was by this time chiefly concerned with mathematical problems that arise in the study of fluid dynamics. A paper on war games was merely a half-hearted effort, designed to justify his employment at Rand and to be hastily drafted before he returned to Cambridge at the beginning of September. But Nash and Milner did collaborate on one project, an experiment on bargaining involving hired subjects that was to become unexpectedly a much-cited classic. The experiment, designed with two researchers from the University of Michigan who were also at Rand for the summer, anticipated by several decades the now-thriving field of experimental economics. The Rand experiments grew more or less directly out of the habit of playing games that the mathematicians indulged in their spare time. Inventing new games and trying them out, always with the inventors as subjects, had been a popular pastime at Princeton. Many of the players had, like Nash, only recently outgrown boyhood passions for chemistry and electricity experiments. The idea of recording the play to see whether people played the way the theory predicted was already a bit of a tradition at Rand, inaugurated by the famous Prisoner's Dilemma experiment. Martha was astonished to learn that the volunteers were earning $50 a day to play games. The experiment, which was conducted over a 2-day period, was designed to test how well different theories of coalitions and bargaining held up when real people were making the decisions. Von Neumann and Morgenstern, with their interest in games with many players, focused on coalitions, groups of people who act in unison. They argued that rational players would calculate the benefits of joining every possible coalition and choose the best one. That is, the one that was most advantageous to them, whether they were business executives intent on collusion or workers who wanted to join a union. Nash, Milner, and the other researchers hired 8 subjects, college students and housewives. They devised different games, mostly with 4 rotating players, one with as many as 7. The game mimicked the general N-person game of von Neumann's theory. Subjects were told they could win cash by forming coalitions, and the specific amounts that would be awarded to each possible coalition. To be eligible to win, however, the coalition partners had to commit in advance to a given division of the winnings. According to Al Roth, a leading experimental economist, the experiment yielded 2 insights that proved highly influential. For one thing, it drew attention to information possessed by participants. If the same players play the game repeatedly, the authors concluded, players tend to regard a run of plays as a single play of a more complicated game. Second, like the prisoner's dilemma experiment devised by Melvin Drescher and Merrill Flood in 1950, it showed that players' decisions were often motivated by concerns about fairness. In particular, in situations in which neither player had a privileged position, players typically opted to split the difference. For the designers of the experiment, however, the results merely cast doubt on the predictive power of game theory and undermined whatever confidence they still had in the subject. Milner was particularly disillusioned. Though he continued at Rand as a consultant for another decade, he lost interest in mathematical models of social interaction, concluding that they were not likely to evolve to a useful or intellectually satisfying stage in the foreseeable future. The strong assumptions of rationality on which both the work of von Neumann and Nash were constructed struck him as particularly fatal. After Nash won the Nobel Prize in 1994, Milner wrote an essay on Nash's mathematical work, in which he essentially adopted the widespread view among pure mathematicians that Nash's work on game theory was trivial compared with his subsequent work in pure mathematics. In the essay, Milner writes, "As with any theory which constructs a mathematical model for some real-life problem, we must ask how realistic the model is. Does it help us to understand the real world? Does it make predictions which can be tested? First, let us ask about the realism of the underlying model. The hypothesis is that all the players are rational, that they understand the precise rules of the game, and that they have complete information about the objectives of all the other players. Clearly, this is seldom completely true. One point which should particularly be noticed is the linearity hypothesis of Nash's theorem. This is a direct application of the von Neumann-Morgenstern theory of numerical utility, the claim that it is possible to measure the relative desirability of different possible outcomes by a real-valued function which is linear with respect to probabilities. My own belief is that this is quite reasonable as a normative theory, but that it may not be realistic as a descriptive theory. Evidently, Nash's theory was not a finished answer to the problem of understanding competitive situations. In fact, it should be emphasized that no simple mathematical theory can provide a complete answer, since the psychology of the players and the mechanism of their interaction may be crucial to a more precise understanding. Nevertheless, decades later, economists differing with Milner came to regard this failure of an experiment as a very worthwhile one. Casual as the experiment was in one sense, it became a model for a new method of economic research, one that had never before been tried in the 200 years since Adam Smith dreamed up the invisible hand. The feeling was that even if the experiments weren't sophisticated enough to show how people's brains work, watching the way people played games could draw researchers' attention to elements of interaction, such as signaling or implicit threats, that couldn't be derived axiomatically. By the time the experiment was run, the relationship between Nash and Milner had become strained, and Milner had moved out of the Georgina Avenue apartment. Milner says now that Nash made a sexual overture toward him. "I was very naive and very homophobic," said Milner. "It wasn't the kind of thing people talked about then." But what Nash felt toward Milner may have been something close to love. A dozen years later, in a letter to Milner, Nash wrote, "Concerning love, I know a conjugation, amo, amas, amat, amamus, amatus, amant. Perhaps amas is also the imperative love. Perhaps one must be very masculine to use the imperative." Chapter 19, Reds, Spring 1953. "Now, the thing I think would interest the committee very greatly, if you could possibly explain to them, Doctor, how you can account for what would seem to be an abnormally large percentage of communists at MIT. Robert L. Kunzig, Counsel, HUAC, April 22, 1953. The Cold War promised to be the sugar daddy of the MIT mathematics department, but McCarthyism, which blamed the setbacks in that war on sinister conspiracies and domestic subversion, threatened to devour it. While Nash and his graduate student friends were shooting each other down and playing games in the mathematics common room, FBI investigators were fanning out around Cambridge, rifling through trash cans, placing individuals under surveillance and questioning neighbors, colleagues, students, and even children. Their targets, as Nash and everyone else at MIT would learn in early 1953, included the chairman and the deputy chairman of the MIT Mathematics Department, as well as a tenured full professor of mathematics, Dirk Struick. All three one-time members, indeed leading members, of the Cambridge cell of the Communist Party. All three were subpoenaed by the House Un-American Activities Committee. It was a state of siege, and everyone in the mathematics department felt the threat. At the time, Nash was no doubt far more preoccupied with the draft, not to mention growing complications of his personal life, than with the possible repercussions for himself of the persecution of his benefactors. Nevertheless, the whole episode was a warning that the world he and other mathematicians inhabited was an extremely fragile one. A congressional committee could destroy your career, just as your draft board could send you halfway around the world. The whole thing had begun as a farce. McCarthy's original list of communists, announced in February 1950, was studded with academics, including the father of Nash's friend Lloyd Shapley, Harvard astronomy professor Harlow Shapley, whom McCarthy incorrectly identified to reporters as Howard Shipley, astrologer. But as the Red Hunt gathered momentum, the entire scientific community felt vulnerable. Princeton's Solomon Lefschetz would be identified as a possible communist sympathizer by an investigative body. Within a year, Robert Oppenheimer, head of the Manhattan Project, one of the most revered scientists in America and the director of the Institute for Advanced Study, would be humiliated by the McCarthyites. When the subpoenas were issued, nobody knew how MIT would handle the matter. Other universities had responded with immediate firings and suspensions. McCarthyism was a big threat to these schools, Zipporah Levinson, Norman Levinson's widow, recalled. During the war, the government had started pouring money into them. The threat was that the research money would dry up. It was a bread-and-butter issue. Martin and Levinson were certain that they were about to lose their jobs and wind up blacklisted for good, like so many others. Levinson talked about becoming a plumber and specializing in the repair of furnaces. The investigators had their eye on the three Browder boys, sons of former Communist Party head Earl Browder, who had all studied or were studying mathematics at MIT and were scholarship recipients as well. MIT was turned topsy-turvy, Mrs. Levinson recalled. The faculty debated and debated how to prove that MIT was patriotic. There was strong pressure to name names. As it turned out, Carl Compton, the president of the university and an outspoken liberal, who was a supporter of the Chinese Revolution and a critic of Chiang Kai-shek, may have felt that he himself would soon be subpoenaed. He hired a white-shoe Boston law firm, Choate, Hall & Stewart, to defend Martin, Levinson, and the others for a minimal fee. By April, when Martin and Levinson were forced to testify, the Tech was running daily stories and anti-McCarthy sentiment was running high on campus. There is no evidence that the FBI ever questioned Nash or any other students or faculty in the department, or asked for depositions in an effort to establish a link between Levinson's and Martin's Communist Party membership and classified defense research, a link that probably never existed given that both left the party soon after the end of the war. The graduate students and junior faculty in the department stood on the sidelines and watched lives and careers ruined, and homes, even car insurance, lost. By that time, young people had prospects, jobs, optimism, Mrs. Levinson recalled. The younger people, Nash's group, didn't want to be too friendly. They were scared. They distanced themselves. Martin and several others named their former associates. Norman Levinson refused to name anyone who had not been previously named. Ted and Izzy Amador hemmed and hawed. Norman knew that Ted Martin and Izzy would cooperate. They spilled all the names. Norman said he'd talk freely about the party, but that he wouldn't name names. The lawyer told Norman, "No, you don't have to say any names." He'd cooperate, but he wouldn't give any names. Martin gave a pathetic, frightened performance. Levinson's testimony, by contrast, demonstrated the qualities of intellect and character that made him such a force in the mathematics community. In a series of forceful and eloquent answers to direct questioning, he managed at one and the same time to defend the youthful idealism that led him into the party, attack the intellectual poverty of communism, and implicitly call into question the committee's assumption that communism was a threat to the nation. He spoke out against the hounding of former party members and asked the committee to take a stand against the blacklisting of Browder's oldest son, Felix, who had finished his Ph.D. and was unable to obtain an academic post. Thanks to MIT's support and the compromises they struck, Levinson and the others kept their jobs. But the whole dispiriting affair, which had been preceded by months of harassment and threats, left deep scars on everyone involved. Martin in particular was shattered and deeply depressed, and was unable nearly 45 years later to talk about it. Levinson's younger daughter, a student in junior high school, suffered a breakdown and was diagnosed with manic depression. Levinson and his wife blamed it partly on her being harassed by the FBI. And those on the periphery, ostensibly unaffected, learned a lesson, namely that the world they so very much took for granted was dangerously fragile and vulnerable to forces beyond its control. Nash took no part in the heated discussions among some of the graduate students over the morality of the mathematician's decision to cooperate with the government. Any discussion of morality raised for him the specter of hypocrisy. But the angry, frightening, turbulent time would supply him with some of the prosecutory demons that came to haunt him later. Chapter 20. Geometry. There are two kinds of mathematical contributions: work that's important to the history of mathematics, and work that's simply a triumph of the human spirit. Paul J. Cohen, 1996. In the spring of 1953, Paul Halmos, a mathematician at the University of Chicago, received the following letter from his old friend Warren Ambrose, a colleague of Nash's. "There's no significant news from here, as always. Martin is appointing John Nash to an assistant professorship, not the Nash at Illinois, the one out of Princeton by Steenrod. And I'm pretty annoyed at that. Nash is a childish, bright guy who wants to be basically original, which I suppose is fine for those who have some basic originality in them. He also makes a damned fool of himself in various ways contrary to this philosophy. He recently heard of the unsolved problem about embedding a Riemannian manifold isometrically in Euclidean space, felt that this was his sort of thing, provided the problem were sufficiently worthwhile to justify his efforts. So he proceeded to write to everyone in the Math Society to check on that, was told that it probably was, and proceeded to announce that he had solved it, modulo details, and told Mackey he would like to talk about it at the Harvard colloquium. Meanwhile, he went to Levinson to inquire about a differential equation that intervened, and Levinson says it is a system of partial differential equations, and if he could only get to the essentially simpler analog of a single ordinary differential equation, it would be a damned good paper. And Nash had only the vaguest notions about the whole thing, so it is generally conceded he's getting nowhere and making an even bigger ass of himself than he's been previously supposed by those with less insight than myself. But we've got him, and saved ourselves the possibility of having gotten a real mathematician. He's a bright guy, but conceited as hell, childish as wiener, hasty as X, obstreperous as Y for arbitrary X and Y." Ambrose had every reason to be both skeptical and annoyed. Ambrose was a moody, intense, somewhat frustrated mathematician in his late 30s, full, as his letter indicates, of black humor. He was a radical and nonconformist. He married 3 times. He gave a lecture on Why I Am an Atheist. He once tried to defend some left-wing demonstrators against police in Argentina and got himself beaten up and jailed for his efforts. He was also a jazz fanatic, a personal friend of Charlie Parker, and a fine trumpet player. Handsome, solidly built, with a boxer's broken nose, the consequence of an accident in an elevator, he was one of the most popular members of the department, and he and Nash clashed from the start. Ambrose's manner was calculated to give an impression of stupidity. "I'm a simple man, I can't understand this." Robert Alman recalled, "Ambrose came to class one day with one shoelace tied and the other untied. 'Did you know your right shoelace is untied?' we asked. 'Oh my God,' he said, 'I tied the left one and thought the other must be tied by considerations of symmetry.'" The older faculty in the department mostly ignored Nash's put-downs and jibes. Ambrose did not. Soon a tit-for-tat rivalry was underway. Ambrose was famous, among other things, for detail. His blackboard notes were so dense that rather than attempt the impossible task of copying them, one of his assistants used to photograph them. Nash, who disliked laborious step-by-step expositions, found much to mock. When Ambrose wrote what Nash considered an ugly argument on the blackboard during a seminar, Nash would mutter, "Hack, hack," from the back of the room. Nash made Ambrose the target of several pranks. "Seminar on the real mathematics," read a sign that Nash posted one day. "The seminar will meet weekly, Thursdays at 2 p.m. in the common room." Thursday at 2 p.m. was the hour that Ambrose taught his graduate course on analysis. On another occasion, after Ambrose delivered a lecture at the Harvard Mathematics Colloquium, Nash arranged to have a large bouquet of red roses delivered to the podium, as if Ambrose were a ballerina taking her bows. Ambrose needled back. He wrote, "Fuck myself," on the to-do list that Nash kept hanging over his desk on a clipboard. It was he who nicknamed Nash Ganache for constantly making belittling remarks about other mathematicians. And during a discussion in the common room after one of Nash's diatribes about hacks and drones, Ambrose said disgustedly, "If you're so good, why don't you solve the embedding problem for manifolds?" A notoriously difficult problem that had been around since it was posed by Riemann. So Nash did. 2 years later, at the University of Chicago, Nash began a lecture describing his first really big theorem by saying, "I did this because of a bet." Nash's opening statement spoke volumes about who he was. He was a mathematician who viewed mathematics not as a grand scheme, but as a collection of challenging problems. In the taxonomy of mathematicians, there are problem solvers and theoreticians, and by temperament, Nash belonged to the first group. He was not a game theorist, analyst, algebraist, geometer, topologist, or mathematical physicist, but he zeroed in on areas in these fields where essentially nobody had achieved anything. The thing was to find an interesting question that he could say something about. Before taking on Ambrose's challenge, Nash wanted to be certain that solving the problem would cover him with glory. He not only quizzed various experts on the problem's importance, but, according to Felix Browder, another Moore instructor, claimed to have proved the result long before he actually had. When a mathematician at Harvard confronted Nash, recalled Browder, Nash explained that he wanted to find out whether it was worth working on. "The discussion of manifolds was everywhere," said Joseph Kohn in 1995, gesturing to the air around him. The precise question that Ambrose asked Nash in the common room one day was the following: "Is it possible to embed any Riemannian manifold in a Euclidean space?" It's a deep philosophical question concerning the foundations of geometry that virtually every mathematician, from Riemann and Hilbert to Élie-Joseph Cartan and Hermann Weyl, working in the field of differential geometry for the past century, had asked himself. The question, first posed explicitly by Ludwig Schlafly in the 1870s, had evolved naturally from a progression of other questions that had been posed and partly answered beginning in the mid-19th century. First, mathematicians studied ordinary curves, then surfaces, and finally, thanks to Riemann, a sickly German genius and one of the great figures of 19th century mathematics, geometric objects in higher dimensions. Riemann discovered examples of manifolds inside Euclidean spaces. But in the early 1950s, interest shifted to manifolds partly because of the large role that distorted space and time relationships had in Einstein's theory of relativity. Nash's own description of the embedding problem in his 1995 Nobel autobiography hints at the reason he wished to make sure that solving the problem would be worth the effort. The problem, although classical, was not much talked about as an outstanding problem. It was not like, for example, the four-color conjecture. Embedding involves portraying a geometric object as, or a bit more precisely, making it a subset of, some space in some dimension. Take the surface of a balloon. You can't put it on a blackboard, which is a two-dimensional space, but you can make it a subset of spaces of three or more dimensions. Now take a slightly more complicated object, say a Klein bottle. A Klein bottle looks like a tin can whose lid and bottom have been removed, and whose top has been stretched around and reconnected through the side to the bottom. If you think about it, it's obvious that if you try that in three-dimensional space, the thing intersects itself. That's bad from a mathematical point of view, because the neighborhood in the immediate vicinity of the intersection looks weird and irregular, and attempts to calculate various attributes like distance or rates of change in that part of the object tend to blow up. But put the same Klein bottle into a space of four dimensions, and the thing no longer intersects itself. Like a ball embedded in three space, a Klein bottle in four space becomes a perfectly well-behaved manifold. Nash's theorem stated that any kind of surface that embodied a special notion of smoothness can actually be embedded in Euclidean space. He showed that you could fold the manifold like a silk handkerchief without distorting it. Nobody would have expected Nash's theorem to be true. In fact, everyone would have expected it to be false. It showed incredible originality, said Mikhail Gromov, the geometer whose book Partial Differential Relations builds on Nash's work. He went on, "Many of us have the power to develop existing ideas. We follow paths prepared by others. But most of us could never produce anything comparable to what Nash produced. It's like lightning striking. Psychologically, the barrier he broke is absolutely fantastic. He has completely changed the perspective on partial differential equations. There's been some tendency in recent decades to move from harmony to chaos. Nash says chaos is just around the corner." John Conway, the Princeton mathematician who discovered surreal numbers and invented the game of life, called Nash's result one of the most important pieces of mathematical analysis in this century. It was also, one must add, a deliberate jab at then-fashionable approaches to Riemannian manifolds, just as Nash's approach to the theory of games was a direct challenge to von Neumann's. Ambrose, for example, was himself involved in a highly abstract and conceptual description of such manifolds at the time. As Jürgen Moser, a young German mathematician who came to know Nash well in the mid-1950s, put it, "Nash didn't like that style of mathematics at all. He was out to show that this, to his mind, exotic approach was completely unnecessary, since any such manifold was simply a submanifold of a high-dimensional Euclidean space." Nash's more important achievement may have been the powerful technique he invented to obtain his result. In order to prove his theorem, Nash had to confront a seemingly insurmountable obstacle, solving a certain set of partial differential equations that were impossible to solve with existing methods. That obstacle cropped up in many mathematical and physical problems. It was the difficulty that Levinson, according to Ambrose's letter, pointed out to Nash. And it is a difficulty that crops up in many, many problems, in particular nonlinear problems. Typically, in solving an equation, the thing that is given is some function, and one finds estimates of derivatives of a solution in terms of derivatives of the given function. Nash's solution was remarkable in that the a priori estimates lost derivatives. Nobody knew how to deal with such equations. Nash invented a novel iterative method, a procedure for making a series of educated guesses, for finding roots of equations, and combined it with a technique for smoothing to counteract the loss of derivatives. Neumann described Nash as a very poetic, different kind of thinker. In this instance, Nash used differential calculus, not geometric pictures or algebraic manipulations, methods that were classical outgrowths of 19th century calculus. The technique is now referred to as the Nash-Moser theorem, although there is no dispute that Nash was its originator. Jürgen Moser was to show how Nash's technique could be modified and applied to celestial mechanics, the movement of planets, especially for establishing the stability of periodic orbits. Nash solved the problem in two steps. He discovered that one could embed a Riemannian manifold in a three-dimensional space if one ignored smoothness. One had, so to speak, to crumple it up. It was a remarkable result, a strange and interesting result, but a mathematical curiosity, or so it seemed. Mathematicians were interested in embedding without wrinkles, embedding in which the smoothness of the manifold could be preserved. In his autobiographical essay, Nash wrote, "So as it happened, as soon as I heard in conversation at MIT about the question of embeddability being open, I began to study it. The first break led to a curious result about the embeddability being realizable in surprisingly low-dimensional ambient spaces, provided that one would accept that the embedding would have only limited smoothness. And later, with heavy analysis, the problem was solved in terms of embedding with a more proper degree of smoothness." Nash presented his initial curious result at a seminar in Princeton, most likely in the spring of 1953, and around the same time that Ambrose wrote his scathing letter to Halmos. Emil Artin was in the audience. He made no secret of his doubts. "Well, that's all well and good, but what about the embedding theorem?" said Artin. "You'll never get it." "I'll get it next week," Nash shot back. One night, possibly en route to this very talk, Nash was hurtling down the Merritt Parkway. Poldy Flatto was riding with him as far as the Bronx. Flatto, like all the other graduate students, knew that Nash was working on the embedding problem. Most likely to get Nash's goat and have the pleasure of watching his reaction, he mentioned that Jacob Schwartz, a brilliant young mathematician at Yale whom Nash knew slightly, was also working on the problem. Nash became quite agitated. He gripped the steering wheel and almost shouted at Flatto, asking whether he had meant to say that Schwartz had solved the problem. "I didn't say that," Flatto corrected. "I said I heard he was working on it." "Working on it?" Nash replied, his whole body now the picture of relaxation. "Well, then there's nothing to worry about. He doesn't have the same insights I have." Schwartz was indeed working on the same problem. Later, after Nash had produced his solution, Schwartz wrote a book on the subject of implicit function theorems. He recalled in 1996, "I got half the idea independently, but I couldn't get the other half. It's easy to see an approximate statement to the effect that not every surface can be exactly embedded, but that you can come arbitrarily close. I got that idea, and I was able to produce the proof of the easy half in a day. But then I realized that there was a technical problem. I worked on it for a month and couldn't see any way to make headway. I ran into an absolute stone wall. I didn't know what to do." Nash worked on that problem for 2 years with a sort of ferocious, fantastic tenacity until he broke through it. Week after week, Nash would turn up in Levinson's office, much as he had in Spencer's at Princeton. He would describe to Levinson what he had done, and Levinson would show him why it didn't work. Isidore Singer, a fellow Moore instructor, recalled, "He'd show the solutions to Levinson. The first few times he was dead wrong, but he didn't give up. As he saw the problem get harder and harder, he applied himself more and more and more. He was motivated just to show everybody how good he was, sure. But on the other hand, he didn't give up, even when the problem turned out to be much harder than expected. He put more and more of himself into it." There's no way of knowing what enables one man to crack a big problem, while another man, also brilliant, fails. Some geniuses have been sprinters who've solved problems quickly. Nash was a long-distance runner. If Nash defied von Neumann in his approach to the theory of games, he now took on the received wisdom of nearly a century. He went into a classical domain where everybody believed that they understood what was possible and not possible. "It took enormous courage to attack these problems," said Paul Cohen, a mathematician at Stanford University and a Fields medalist. His tolerance for solitude, great confidence in his own intuition, indifference to criticism, all detectable at a young age but now prominent and impermeable features of his personality, served him well. He was a hard worker by habit. He worked mostly at night in his MIT office, from 10 in the evening until 3 a.m., and on weekends as well, with, as one observer said, no references but his own mind and his supreme self-confidence. Schwartz called it the ability to continue punching the wall until the stone breaks. The most eloquent description of Nash's single-minded attack on the problem comes from Moser. "The difficulty," that Levinson had pointed out, "to anyone in his right mind, would have stopped them cold and caused them to abandon the problem. But Nash was different. If he had a hunch, conventional criticisms didn't stop him. He had no background knowledge. It was totally uncanny. Nobody could understand how somebody like that could do it. He was the only person I ever saw with that kind of power, just brute mental power. The editors of the Annals of Mathematics hardly knew what to make of Nash's manuscript when it landed on their desks at the end of October 1954. It hardly had the look of a mathematics paper. It was as thick as a book, printed by hand rather than typed, and chaotic. It made use of concepts and terminology more familiar to engineers than to mathematicians. So they sent it to a mathematician at Brown University, Herbert Federer, an Austrian-born refugee from Nazism and a pioneer in surface area theory, who, although only 34, already had a reputation for high standards, superb taste, and an unusual willingness to tackle difficult manuscripts. Mathematics is often described, quite rightly, as the most solitary of endeavors. But when a serious mathematician announces that he has found the solution to an important problem, at least one other serious mathematician, and sometimes several, as a matter of long-standing tradition that goes back hundreds of years, will set aside his own work for weeks and months at a time, as one former collaborator of Federer's put it, to make a go of it and straighten everything out. Nash's manuscript presented Federer with a sensationally complicated puzzle, and he attacked the task with relish. The collaboration between author and referee took months. A large correspondence, many telephone conversations, and numerous drafts ensued. Nash did not submit the revised version of the paper until nearly the end of the following summer. His acknowledgement to Federer was, by Nash's standards, effusive. "I'm profoundly indebted to H. Federer, to whom may be traced most of the improvement over the first chaotic formulation of this work." Armand Barrell, who was a visiting professor at Chicago when Nash gave a lecture on his embedding theorem, remembers the audience's shocked reaction. "Nobody believed his proof at first," he recalled in 1995. "People were very skeptical. It looked like a beguiling idea, but when there's no technique, you're skeptical. You dream about a vision. Usually you're missing something." People did not challenge him publicly, but they talked privately. Characteristically, Nash's report to his parents merely said, "Talks went well." Giancarlo Rota, professor of mathematics and philosophy at MIT, confirmed Borel's account. "One of the great experts on the subject told me that if one of his graduate students had proposed such an outlandish idea, he'd have thrown him out of his office." The result was so unexpected, and Nash's methods so novel, that even the experts had tremendous difficulty understanding what he had done. Nash used to leave drafts lying around the MIT common room. A former MIT graduate student recalls a long and confused discussion between Ambrose Singer and Masatake Kuranishi, a mathematician at Columbia University who later applied Nash's result, in which each one tried to explain Nash's result to the other. Without much success. Jack Schwartz recalled, "Nash's solution was not just novel, but very mysterious. A mysterious set of weird inequalities that all came together. In my explication of it, I sort of looked at what happened and could generalize and give an abstract form and realize it was applicable to situations other than the specific one he treated, but I didn't quite get to the bottom of it either." Later, Heinz Hopf, professor of mathematics in Zurich and a past president of the International Mathematical Union, a great man with a small build, friendly, radiating a warm glow, who knew everything about differential geometry, gave a talk on Nash's embedding theorem in New York. Usually, Hopf's lectures were models of crystalline clarity. Moser, who was in the audience, recalled, "So we thought, now we'll understand what Nash did." He was naturally skeptical. He would have been an important validator of Nash's work. But as the lecture went on, my God, Hopf was befuddled himself. He couldn't convey a complete picture. He was completely overwhelmed. Several years later, Jürgen Moser tried to get Nash to explain how he had overcome the difficulties that Levinson had originally pointed out. "I did not learn so much from him. When he talked, he was vague, hand-waving. You have to control this, you have to watch out for that. You couldn't follow him, but his written paper was complete and correct." Federer not only edited Nash's paper to make it more accessible, but also was the first to convince the mathematical community that Nash's theorem was indeed correct. Martin's surprise proposal in the early part of 1953 to offer Nash a permanent faculty position set off a storm of controversy among the 18-member mathematics faculty. Levinson and Wiener were among Nash's strongest supporters, but others like Warren Ambrose and George Whitehead, the distinguished topologist, were opposed. More instructorships weren't meant to lead to tenure-track positions. More to the point, Nash had made plenty of enemies and few friends in his first year and a half. His disdainful manner toward his colleagues and his poor record as a teacher rubbed many the wrong way. Mostly, however, Nash's opponents were of the opinion that he hadn't proved he could produce. Whitehead recalled, "He talked big. Some of us were not sure he could live up to his claims." Ambrose, not surprisingly, felt similarly. Even Nash's champions could not have been completely certain. Flatto remembered one occasion on which Nash came to Levinson's office to ask Levinson whether he'd read a draft of his embedding paper. Levinson said, "To tell you the truth, I don't have enough background in this area to pass judgment." When Nash finally succeeded, Ambrose did what a fine mathematician and sterling human being would do. His applause was as loud as, or louder than, anyone else's. The bantering became friendlier, and among other things, Ambrose took to telling his musical friends that Nash's whistling was the purest, most beautiful tone he had ever heard. Part 2. Separate Lives. Chapter 21. Singularity. Nash was leading all these separate lives, completely separate lives. Arthur Maddock, 1997. All through his childhood, adolescence, and brilliant student career, Nash had seemed largely to live inside his own head, immune to the emotional forces that bind people together. His overriding interest was in patterns, not people, and his greatest need was making sense of the chaos within and without by employing to the largest possible extent the resources of his own powerful, fearless, fertile mind. His apparent lack of ordinary human needs was, if anything, a matter of pride and satisfaction to him, confirming his own uniqueness. He thought of himself as a rationalist, a free thinker, a sort of Spock of the starship Enterprise. But now, as he entered early adulthood, this unfettered persona was shown to be partly a fiction, or at least partly superseded. In those first years at MIT, he discovered that he had some of the same wishes as others. The cerebral, playful, calculating, and episodic connections that had once sufficed no longer served. In 5 short years, between the ages of 24 and 29, Nash became emotionally involved with at least 3 other men. He acquired and then abandoned a secret mistress who bore his child. And he courted, or rather was courted by, a woman who became his wife. As these initial intimate connections multiplied and became ever-present elements in his consciousness, Nash's formerly solitary but coherent existence became at once richer and more discontinuous, separate and parallel existences that reflected an emerging adult but a fragmented and contradictory self. The others on whom he now depended occupied different compartments of his life and often for long periods knew nothing of one another or of the nature of the other's relation to Nash. Only Nash was in the know. His life resembled a play in which successive scenes are acted by only 2 characters. One character is in all of them, while the second changes from scene to scene. The second character seems no longer to exist when he disappears from the boards. More than a decade later, when he was already ill, Nash himself provided a metaphor for his life during the MIT years, a metaphor that he couched in his first language, the language of mathematics. B squared plus RTF equals 0. A very personal equation Nash included in a 1968 postcard that begins, "Dear Maddock, thinking that you will understand this concept better than most, I wish to explain." The equation represents a 3-dimensional hyperspace, which has a singularity at the origin in 4-dimensional space. Nash is the singularity, the special point. and the other variables are people who affected him, in this instance men with whom he had friendships or relationships. Inevitably, the accretion of significant relationships with others brings with it demands for integration, the necessity of having to choose. Nash had little desire to choose one emotional connection over another. By not choosing, he could avoid or at least minimize both dependence and demands. To satisfy his own emotional needs for connectiveness meant he inevitably made others look to him to satisfy theirs. Yet while he was preoccupied with the effect of others on him, he mostly ignored, indeed seemed unable to grasp, his effect on others. He had, in fact, no more sense of the other than does a very young child. He wished the others to be satisfied with his genius. "I thought I was such a great mathematician," he was to say ruefully, looking back at this period. And of course, to some extent, they were satisfied. But when people inevitably wanted or needed more, he found the strains unbearable. Chapter 22. A Special Friendship. Santa Monica, Summer, 1952. Away from contact with a few special sorts of individuals, I am lost. Lost completely in the wilderness. So it's been a hard life in many ways. John Forbes Nash, Jr., 1965. After John Nash lost everything, family, career, the ability to think about mathematics, he confided in a letter to his sister Martha that only three individuals in his life had ever brought him any real happiness. Three special sorts of individuals with whom he had formed special friendships. Had Martha seen the Beatles film A Hard Day's Night? "They seem very colorful and amusing," he wrote. "Of course they're much younger, like the sort of person I've mentioned. I feel often as if I were similar to the girls that love the Beatles so wildly, since they seem so attractive and amusing to me." Nash's first loves were one-sided and unrequited. Nash was always forming intense friendships with men that had a romantic quality, Donald Newman observed in 1996. He was very adolescent, always with the boys. Some were inclined to see Nash's infatuations as experiments or simple expressions of his immaturity, a view that he may well have held himself. "He played around with it because he liked to play around. He was very experimental, very try-outish," said Newman in 1996. "Mostly he just kissed." Newman, who liked to joke about his past and future female conquests, had first-hand knowledge because Nash was for a time infatuated with him, with predictable results. "He used to talk about how Donald looked all the time," Mrs. Newman said in 1996. Newman recalled, "He tried fiddling around with me. I was driving my car when he came on to me." DJ and Nash were cruising around in Newman's white Thunderbird when Nash kissed him on the mouth. DJ just laughed it off. Nash's first experience of mutual attraction, special friendships as he called them, occurred in Santa Monica. It was the very end of the summer of 1952, after Milner had moved out and Martha had flown back home. The encounter must have been fleeting, coming in the last days of August, just before he was due to leave for Boston, and very furtive. But it was nonetheless decisive, because for the first time he found not rejection, but reciprocity. Thus it was the first real step out of his extreme emotional isolation, and the world of relationships that were purely imaginary. A first taste of intimacy, not entirely happy, no doubt, but suggestive of hitherto unsuspected satisfactions. The only traces of Nash's friendship with Irvin Thorson that remain are his description of him as a special friend in his 1965 letter, and a series of elliptical references to T in letters in the late 1960s. Few, if any, of Nash's acquaintances met him. Martha recalled a friend of Nash's who once spent the night on the couch of their Georgina Avenue apartment, but not his name. Thorson, who died in 1992, was 30 years old in 1952. He was a native Californian of Scandinavian extraction. Nash described him to Martha as an aerospace engineer, but he may in fact have been an applied mathematician. He had been a meteorologist in the Army Air Corps during the war. Afterward, he earned a master's degree in mathematics at UCLA and went to Douglas Aircraft in 1951, just a few years after Douglas had spun off its R&D division to form the RAND Corporation. At that time, Douglas was mapping the future of interplanetary travel for the Pentagon, and Thorson, who eventually led a research team, was very likely involved in these efforts. His great passion, conceived 20 years before the United States launched Viking, was the dream of exploring Mars, his sister Nelda Troutman recalled in 1997. Thorson was, his sister said, very high-strung, not a social person at all, very bright, knew a lot, very, very academic. Nash could easily have met him, given the close ties between Douglas and Rand, which was also heavily involved in studies of space exploration, at a talk or a seminar, or perhaps even at one of the parties that John Williams, the head of Rand's mathematics department, gave. If Thorson, who never married, was a homosexual, his surviving sister did not know it. With his family, at any rate, he was unusually close-mouthed, not just about his work, which was highly classified, but about all aspects of his personal life. Given the mounting pressure to root out homosexuals in the defense industry during the McCarthy era, Thorson would have had to practice great discretion in any case. His career at Douglas was to last for another 15 years. When he abruptly resigned from Douglas in 1968, he apparently did so at the age of 47 because he feared dying. Several of his colleagues had recently died of heart attacks, and Thorson, who had some sort of mild heart condition, decided he couldn't cope with the stress and overwork anymore. He moved back to his hometown of Pomona and became a virtual recluse, except for an active involvement in the Lutheran Church, living with his parents for the next 25 years until his death. Whether Nash and Thorson saw each other again when Nash returned to Santa Monica for a third summer 2 years later, or on one of his trips to Santa Monica during his illness in the early and mid-1960s, is not known. But Nash continued to think of Thorson, and to refer to him obliquely, until at least 1968. Chapter 23, Eleanor. These mathematicians are very exclusive. They occupy a very high terrain from which they look down on everyone else. That makes their relationships with women quite problematic. Zipporah Levinson, 1995. Nash was back in Boston, in his old quarters by Labor Day. Number 407 Beacon Street was an imposing brick row house built before the turn of the century, facing the Charles. Its current owner, Mrs. Austin Grant, was the widow of a Back Bay physician. She liked to point out her home's opulent features to her lodgers, such as the carriage room, where its original owners once waited for their horse-drawn carriages to be brought around. And she often bemoaned the neighborhood's decline. "Don't leave your bags on the street while you come in. They might not be there when you come out again," she said to Nash the day he moved in. Nash occupied one of the front bedrooms, a large, comfortably furnished room with a fireplace. Lindsay Russell, a young engineer who had recently graduated from MIT, lived next door. Mrs. Grant regularly took Russell aside to remark on Nash's idiosyncrasies. Nash acquired a huge set of barbells and began lifting weights. When Nash made the dining room chandelier, which hung directly below his bedroom, vibrate with his exertions, Mrs. Grant would say, "What does he think this is, a gymnasium?" Nash's mail also received comment, particularly the postcards from his mother, expressing the hope, as Russell recalled, that in addition to the pursuit of mathematics and other intellectual pursuits, he would make friends and engage in social activities. With one single exception, however, Nash never had any visitors. Russell remembers once waking in the middle of the night. There was a sound coming from Nash's room. It was a giggle. The giggle of a woman. The pretty dark-haired nurse who admitted Nash to the hospital on the second Thursday in September was named Eleanor. He was due to have some varicose veins removed, and seemed awfully nervous, and young, more like a student than a professor. Eleanor knew his doctor to be a notorious incompetent and a drunk. She was curious how an MIT professor had wound up with a quack like that. Nash told her that he'd chosen the doctor at random by closing his eyes and running his fingers down the list of physicians in the lobby. She felt, she recalled, rather protective of him. Nash was on the ward for only a couple of days. Eleanor thought he was cute and sort of sweet, but when he left she hardly expected to see him again. Somehow or other they bumped into each other on the street not long afterward. It was a Saturday afternoon, and Eleanor was on her way to meet a friend to buy herself a good winter coat. "I didn't chase him. He chased me. He kept pestering me," Eleanor recalled. "I wound up going shopping with him." They walked over to Jay's department store together. Nash followed her up to the coat department, which was on the second floor. He kept staring at her, not saying much, waiting for her to choose a coat. She started to enjoy herself. John was very attractive, Eleanor recalled, laughing. When I saw him, I thought he was something special. She began pointing to the ones she wanted to try on, and with elaborate courtesy, he held out each coat for her to slip into. She thought she liked a purple one best. Nash started clowning around. He pretended he was her tailor, flung himself on his knees before her, loudly made believe he was measuring her coat for alterations, and generally made a fool of himself. Embarrassed, Eleanor blushed, protested, and tried to hush him up. "Get up quick," she whispered. Secretly, however, she was quite thrilled. At 29, Eleanor was an attractive, hard-working, tender-hearted woman. A friend of Nash's later described her as dark and pretty, quite shy, a good person of ordinary intelligence, with simple manners and a very peculiar way of speaking. By that, the friend meant that her accent was pure New England. Life hadn't been very kind to her. She'd grown up in Jamaica Plain, a dreary blue-collar section of Boston. She'd had a hard-scrabble childhood, a harsh mother, and the burden, far too heavy for a young girl, of caring for a younger half-brother. She missed a great deal of school as a result. She was, on the whole, grateful to be able to take up a profession, practical nursing, that she enjoyed and that provided her with steady work. Her mother died of tuberculosis when Eleanor was 18. Her early experiences endowed her with a soft heart. She had a deep appreciation, which stayed with her all her life, for what it was like to be poor and vulnerable. It brought out a tenderness in her toward patients, neighbors, other people's children, and stray animals. She was the kind of woman who later in life would literally give coats to strangers and invite people who had nowhere else to stay into her home. Shy and lacking confidence, Eleanor also tended to be suspicious and guarded, especially around men. She said in an interview, "I wasn't a bad girl. I didn't run around with a lot of men. In fact, I was really good. I was a little afraid of men. I didn't want to be involved with them sexually. I thought it was kind of disgusting." But Nash disarmed her from the start. Yes, he was an MIT professor. Yes, he came from an upper-class sort of background. Yes, he did top-secret work for the government. But he was also very young, 5 years Eleanor's junior. There was a sweetness about him, a lack of guile. She sensed, moreover, that he was, if anything, less experienced than she was. After that Saturday afternoon, Nash took her out for cheap meals and drove her around in his beat-up car. He talked about himself, his work, the department, his friends, endlessly. He hardly asked her anything about herself, something that relieved rather than distressed her. She wasn't eager to share the rather dispiriting details of her modest background, particularly as Nash hinted that his own ancestry was rather distinguished. He pressed her to let him come up to her apartment. She wouldn't let him at first. She didn't want to seem easy. But she finally agreed to go to his place. She found him eager, ardent, but not frightening. That Nash, who had preferred dancing with chairs to dancing with girls as an adolescent, and who had given the pretty Ruth Hinks not so much as a real glance, progressed so swiftly and had so suddenly, and at that particular moment found his way into a woman's arms, suggests either love at first sight or some resolution to take the plunge. The encounter with Thorson might have provided the impetus. Nash may have been looking to repeat a loving experience, or he may have been looking for confirmation of his own masculinity. On a number of occasions, he asked Eleanor to provide him with steroids. "There were always big bottles of stuff around the places I worked as a nurse," said Eleanor. Although she later said that she never acceded to Nash's wishes, she believed that he delved into drugs, hoping that they would make him more manly. He wasn't proving his interest in women to the world, however. He kept his liaison with Eleanor a deep, dark secret for years, even while he displayed his infatuation with various men, more or less in public. Caught up as he was with teaching, seminars, and work on his embedding problem that fall, Nash nonetheless managed to see Eleanor frequently. He confided in her. He enjoyed being alone with her. He liked going over to her place and having her cook him dinner. She cooked very well. She fussed over him. Most of all, she was womanly, full of warmth and artless affection. For Nash, who had never even known a woman other than his mother and sister, it was a novel experience.